Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In Bhutan, where the king has declared the nation's priority to be not gross domestic product, but rather gross national happiness, they started a radio station. Of course they did. And then the Kingdom of Bhutan invited Lisa Napoli, a broadcast media veteran, to help start it. Lisa wanted to get away from it all the media overload, the whole Western civilization mess. Did she find what actor Ronald Colman referred to in this clip from the 1937 Hollywood film version of Lost Horizon?
It's inconceivable.
What?
All of it. Father Perra, his magnificent history. This place, hidden away from the rest of the world, with its glorious concepts.
Or was it a bit more complicated than that? Joining us now is Lisa Napoli, author of Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. Lisa most recently worked as a reporter and backup host for public radio's Marketplace. She's also been a reporter and columnist for the New York Times and on our correspondent for MSNBC and directed documentaries that have aired on public television. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
So was it a little more complicated than a simple, glorious concept?
Yeah, unfortunately. I wish I could tell you that it wasn't, but it is. It's much more complicated than that, like everything.
How did you wind up going there in the first place? It was a mysterious, handsome stranger. And yep. Someone's mentioned karma, too.
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, I guess. I just met a guy at a party who heard I worked in public radio. I bet you get this all the time. People love to talk to you about public radio.
Mm-hmm.
And we were chatting, and he was a tea importer, and I was more interested than public radio. And a few weeks later, he wrote and asked me if I'd be interested in helping start up a radio station in Bhutan. And I knew about this much about Bhutan, but I thought, this guy's cool, the idea is cool, and I started researching, asked my boss for a leave of absence, and off I went.
Were you, you did some research. What in your research convinced you that this was worth the opportunity?
Well, gosh, you know, I probably would have said yes to anything at that point because anything out, getting me out was a good, you know, mm-hmm. escape. But I'm not a vacation person, so I always wait for people to invite me to go places. So that was just my style. No one had ever invited me to go help start a radio station in Asia, though. I had never been to Asia. I knew that's about all I knew about Bhutan. I didn't know it was, until I started researching, that it was surrounded by India and Tibet and Nepal. I did know a little bit about the Gross National Happiness Commitment, but I assumed that had more to do with the fact that the place didn't have television than anything else, and it didn't have television until about 1999. That's when it was allowed into the country. So I assumed that's why people were happy. They were advertising free. I found out that the current or the then king had four wives, all sisters, and that polygamy was allowed for both men and women, not just for royalty and not just for men. And I found out that it was called the Last Shangri-La, as you referenced in that clip, Lost Horizon. It was considered or marketed as, to the very few tourists who are allowed in, and they've only been allowed in for the last 40 years, it's considered to be the last Buddhist kingdom, the last Shangri-La. And because people haven't been going there until the last 40 years, before development is a recent phenomenon, it is a very protected and insulated world. It's not an overbuilt, smokestack-belching Asian country producing stuff that we buy here. It's mm-hmm. very pure and pristine.
My guest is Lisa Napoli. She is the author of Radio Shangri-La. It's a story about her visit to Bhutan, a six-week trip to Bhutan, where she helped start up a new radio station there. So, Lisa, how isolated is Bhutan?
Well, given that it is nestled between these giant nations surrounding it, it's remarkable just how cut off from the outside world it was. It is a very rocky, mountainous place. It's not an easy place, even now that they have a national highway, which is very narrow and winding, to traverse. It's not an easy place to get around. And so there are something like 60% of the people still live within a several-hour walk from a road. So it is a very remote kingdom. And to get there, for those who visit or volunteer, as I did, you have to get to Bangkok or Delhi and then fly from there into the only airport in Bhutan, which is in the western part of the country. And then drive at least a couple of hours to get almost anywhere. So in many cases, I was just there in October, I took a 13-hour drive to go several hundred miles. So it's a very remote place. It's not for everybody. It's just a fascinating place because it is still so pristine. The environment is magnificent. It's unspoiled by development in most places. The capital city and a border town called Fünfling are starting to get busier, much busier, but there's still, with 650,000 people, only 40,000 cars in the whole kingdom. So if that gives you a sense of just how undeveloped it is, it's about the size of Switzerland with 650,000 or so people. It's, you know, it's not Los Angeles, that's for sure.
But it wasn't so many years ago that there were no cars at all. There were no radios. There were no televisions.
Right.
So the country is ripe for change. There's now 40,000 cars where 10 years ago there were barely any.
Right, exactly. And this radio station that I was invited to come help with was the first commercial radio station. There was one sort of public radio-esque station that was run by the government. But the station Kuzu FM that I went with 4 years ago was the very first. And so that created a sensation, the mix of the growing number of cars and just people's zeal for information and media, as there is all around the world, made this station a huge, huge overnight hit. In part because there wasn't much else to listen to, but also because people were so charmed by the idea of radio.
Now, tell us a little bit about the demographics. It was a youth-oriented station. Is that because so much of the population is youthful?
Yeah.
And then when they walk across the border, they turn to dust? Or what is it? Tell us about, you know, who the people are and
sure.
What makes up their population.
Sure. Kuzu FM was started for the youth because, yes, a significant, at least 30% of the population is under the age of, I always forget if it's 25 or 30, but it's a huge number of people are young. The other reason that the radio station was seen as important was cultural preservation, because the government recognizes that by letting in television and movies, that it needs to keep up the culture, its own native culture, as, you know, of course, the same problem people all over the world have. So they felt like the radio station might be a way, a tool for people to keep talking about Bhutan and national heritage and pride. And of course, that's not been exactly the case, because most 20-year-olds, if you give them a radio station, want to play pop music from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, the radio station was seen as important also because the king, just around the time that I agreed to go to Bhutan, abdicated the throne and declared that the first constitution and the first democratically elected government would be installed and or elected. And so the radio station was seen as, media are supposed to be everywhere, a tool of keeping the government in check.
So. You know, Bhutan does not have a perfect record of tolerance, and we'll get to that later, mm-hmm. but it is amazing given the upheaval in the Mideast right now, Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, that in this case, the king abdicated
yes.
and turned it over to
peacefully. Yeah, it is an amazing thing to watch. What's going on in the Middle East right now, where, you know, there are many young people and there's the Twitter revolution that's happened. And to think about Bhutan and that exactly, that just happened willingly. And the people didn't even want the power. The people saw that power. I mean, I guess they've been watching CNN for 10 years and they saw that democratic rule is a loaded issue. Of course, it's a wonderful thing, but it's a complex thing, as is everything. And, you know, they saw that with politics come politics, and they just loved their king and felt that the king had done so much to advance the country that they were worried about electing their own to rule the government, to run the government. So and so far, you know, it's been an interesting thing to watch this baby democracy sort of hatch itself and find its way, figure out how to govern in a place where they're used to a monarchical rule. It's
mm-hmm.
very interesting.
Are they well educated?
Well, it's a very interesting place. People are either super educated and have degrees from the best schools in the world, because those are the smartest kids who are sent out to be educated to run the country. or they're, you know, a lot of illiteracy still. Kids, school is free, so kids can go to school up until the 10th grade as long as they maintain their grades, as long as they can afford a uniform and books, which in some places is still not easy to do. But more and more kids are going to school, and they're going to school in English. The medium of instruction is English. But for the most part, people in our age range probably weren't educated unless you were the best and the brightest plucked out of the village and sent overseas or to India to go for further education. So it's another part of the paradox of the place. You find people who are super sophisticated. One of my friends is from a very small village but was taken out of the village as a young boy and speaks five languages and is incredibly, you know, well traveled around mm-hmm. the world, better than many of my family members and most of my family members. And he, you know, is from this very poor, modest, smartest place. So it's a very interesting place, the kinds of people you meet there, as is the case anywhere. But this for me was a microcosm of the world because that was the place I was lucky enough to fall into.
How does the country support itself? Is it wealthy and just the wealth is concentrated or how does that?
No, it's mostly subsistence farming that still engines, if you will, the country. The per capita income is around $1,300 a year, so it's poor, but it's not as poor, poverty is not evident the way it is, as I understand, in a place like India. Mm-hmm. People live communally, you know, families, large families in one house, and they work the land. That's, of course, all changing, too. Younger people watching TV, getting better educated, don't want to work the land anymore, so they come to the cities and hope for civil servants' jobs and to maybe start a business. But it's a very interesting time for Bhutan because access to capital is growing. There are new banks that are offering loans. People want more things, so they work to make more money than they have before. But before all of that, subsistence farming and now hydroelectric power, which is done in conjunction with the Indian government, the closest ally. India, of course, needs a lot of power, and Bhutan has a lot of water and hills, necessary ingredients for hydropower. So they work together. That's the biggest income generator for the government. And then tourism is also enormously important. That visa, that tourist tax that you mentioned mm-hmm. of now $250 a day, a big slice of that goes to the government for upkeep and maintenance of monuments and monasteries, but also just that's how they make some money, a lot of it.
We have to take a break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Lisa Napoli. She's author of Radio Shangri-La. It's a book about Bhutan, where she spent several weeks helping start up a youth-oriented radio station. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and you can get access to our station anytime online at WOSU.org. Hear local and national news all day, every day, from the convenience of your computer by streaming on the web. Listen to 89.7 NPR News online anytime at WOSU.org. And be sure to watch Columbus on the Record tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. This week, News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson and his panel discuss a new poll that shows Ohioans don't like Senate Bill 5. Also, charter schools face more criticism. All that and more on Columbus on the Record. It's tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. A few clouds and some sunshine today, and a high of 75. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 55 degrees. Sunshine for Saturday, and a high of 82. And then a chance of rain Saturday night, a low of 63. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Okay, Welcome back to All Sides. We were listening to a broadcast from Kuzu FM, the youth-oriented radio station in the Himalayan Kingdom of Bhutan. That's where Lisa Napoli has been. She's traveled there six times since the original visit when she went to help set up that radio station. She's with us now to talk about the book inspired by her trips, Radio Shangri-La. Welcome back, Lisa.
Thank you.
Tell us about the radio station itself and where it was and what you were faced with when you arrived.
It's pretty amazing. You know, we as Westerners and type A personalities like to come into a place and feel like we have a mission. I really had no idea what they wanted me to do with this station. It had been up and running for just a couple of months when I got there, and I knew that they needed some help modernizing themselves, and none of the people there had ever worked in radio before, so I didn't really know what they wanted me to do. And when I walked in, it was really amazing. The studio was in basically an old kitchen in an old foreign minister's house that had just sort of been used for youth-oriented activities. They sort of gave it up for the radio station Kuzu, and in a kitchen with a huge hole in the ceiling and pigeons cooing while you were on the air, that's where they made it happen. And basically, I just hung out every day, hung out with the people there. A lot of what I did was sort of den mother stuff because I was 20 years older than most of the people who were working at the station, and they were so excited to have access to a U.S. citizen because the only ones they'd really seen for the most part were people who were tourists. So for them to hang out with somebody for a while and for me to hang out with them was just a delight. And as you know, a radio station is sort of a center of the universe of a community. It's a really fantastic place, especially when it's new. People were coming in with public service announcements and asking if they could start a show. So it was a real hive of activity, the way a cafe might be. And actually, you know what? I've got a little passage,
okay,
if I might read for you, because I think it's pertinent to what you've just asked,
okay,
if that's okay.
Yes, please.
Great, okay. This is from the Symphony of Love chapter, and I can tell you a little bit more about that. But it doesn't take much to create a radio program, a microphone or two, a mixing board, a transmitter, and a relatively quiet room. That was about all Kuzu had, along with a couple of faded Backstreet Boys and Spice Girls posters taped up on the walls and an on-air sign mounted outside the studio. Its lighting mechanism worked about half the time, but almost everyone ignored it anyway. They'd just barrel into the studio regardless of whether someone was transmitting live. Kuzu FM was what most radio stations in the United States hadn't been for a very long time, and anything goes bullhorn to the people. A core staff of paid radio jockeys kept the station going, but anyone who was interested could just show up and contribute however they wished. You could bring in music, you could hang out in the studio with whoever was hosting the show, though eventually there were rules prohibiting that. You could answer phones. Volunteers weren't just welcome, they were encouraged. Even the typical college station in the United States had long ago ceased to be so egalitarian. And, you know, that's what's so interesting for me, coming from the glossy business journalism world. Not that, you know, everything was perfect, but that really is what tantalized me about this place and made me fall back in love with media. Was this is community media at its finest, and here I was, this outsider, witnessing it and seeing the possibilities. And the people there didn't even see the possibilities themselves, really. They didn't understand how popular they were, how people were so excited that they had something to listen to. They were just kind of doing their job.
What do you think you brought to the table for them? What do you think you taught them?
I don't think a whole lot. I think I really was an emissary from another place, the way any of us who travel are. I'm right now in Colorado meeting native Coloradoans, and I'm enjoying talking to them. And if I came to your city, I'd have the same experience. And that's what I brought there. I was an outsider with a certain perspective of a certain age who basically could answer questions for them. I feel like I'm an open and warm person. So people would ask questions about movies that they'd seen and whether it was true. And I loved being that kind of ambassador from the United States. And I think that that's really what all of us do whenever we go anywhere.
You said, I was going to ask you, what did you learn from being at the radio station yourself? But you did mention that you fell back in love with radio and media.
With the power of it. You know, I was so tired of the grind of it, and I don't think I could go back to the job I was doing, as much as it was a fun job and it was, you know, an important job. telling the news. I loved seeing community media because there's no greater tool. It's so important. And in a place like this, where everybody was listening, it reminded me of when I was a kid growing up in New York and there were just three TV stations, there were a bunch of newspapers, and you felt that everybody was in this community together. They weren't all hibernating with their own internet connection mm-hmm. and watching what they wanted to watch when they wanted to watch it. And there was something very unifying about that, and still is. I love the local newspaper in my community in downtown Los Angeles. It's a weekly. It's not fancy, but it's really good, and it makes me really aware of what's going on in my immediate area. And that's something I think all of us are losing out on because we have such a fantastic, magnificent window to the wider world.
It makes me explains why I like to watch It's a Wonderful Life on television on the network, because I know there's, you know, millions of other people out there watching it at the same
yes,
time.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Wizard of Oz, when we were growing up, Wizard of Oz,
yep.
right, was on TV at the same time. No, there's something really powerful about that, but you lose sight of that as we all lose sight of everything in our lives, all the good things in our lives. We forget about them in our day-to-day because we've got to get through the day. And then day ends and we're too tired to think, huh, there was really some nice things that happened that day. Maybe not earth-shattering, but there were some positive things that day.
In 1972, Bhutan's newly crowned king was concerned about the problem afflicting other developing countries focused only on economic growth. So he decided to make his nation's priority, not its GDP, but its GNH, gross national happiness. What did he mean by happiness?
Well, that's a loaded word, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, happiness means different things to different people. But what he meant was well-being. What he meant was he didn't want the country to grow without any sort of plan and develop wildly at the expense of the environment, develop where people had to commute for 2 hours a day and diminish their quality of life. So he was very committed to environmental preservation, cultural preservation. Yeah, it's cool that we let people in from the outside as visitors and volunteers and whatever, but let's not forget who we are. Let's not forget our national identity. So those kinds of things were what he meant when he said happiness, that rampant economic development, as we've seen in this country in the last 10 years, you know, the dot-com bust, the real estate bust are examples of that. Greed just propelled all of that, not sense and not measured deliberate growth. And that's what his ideal is. And now people all around the world want to study it because everybody's saying, well, that other stuff didn't quite work. So let's figure out another way.
I thought it was impressive that just little things like banning plastic bags.
Yes, although a couple of times in the last few visits, people have tried to put things in plastic bags for me. And as I do here, I say no or mm-hmm. have my own. But it's, past plastic bags, smoking. Those are things that he saw as a scourge and on both the environment and the greater good of the people. And that's paternalistic, yes, but it's also, again, sensible. You know, I guess there are civil libertarians out there who would say if you want to smoke, you should be able to smoke. But, mm-hmm. you know, that's a complicated issue, too, as is everything we're talking about.
There's something that they like, something like chewing tobacco or snuff
yes.
that they really are, at least some of the people are pretty into.
Yeah, it's called Doma, and
yeah.
it's a betel nut wrapped in a leaf with slathered with lime paste, not lime like the fruit, but the lime like, I guess.
From the rock.
The rock. And mm-hmm. It's a really, really intense, it smells like very stinky cheese, and it's kind of unsightly because your teeth turn red and people spit afterwards. But
there must be some big benefit to this.
Yes, I hope so. Oh, I didn't even want to try it. It wasn't even something that I felt the need to experience. I could just tell from looking at it. It apparently warms your inside, supposedly makes you a little bit high, although a lot of the people who use it a lot deny that. But not my thing. But, yes, it's very common there, very, very
And important. They didn't ban that.
They did not ban that. And someone had written, actually, if they tried to ban that, there would probably be a revolt. But so smoking was a little bit different, at least perceived to be a little bit different.
Now, as you said, that some people are studying the mm-hmm. idea of gross national happiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People are very intrigued by this this. And what's funny is when the king made this remark, he didn't have a policy. He didn't have an institute of gross national happiness. He just said, this is how we're going to guide ourselves as we grow. But of course, again, we Westerners want a who, what, when, where, why, and how. Mm-hmm. We want a to-do list. And what's happened is people over the years have said, that's kind of a cool concept. What does it mean? How do you measure happiness? And what they've done is set up something, a commission, to look at how you measure it, how you gauge people's well-being. So they have a very complex questionnaire that they administer now in parts of Bhutan and that other countries are trying to take and adapt for themselves. Actually, Seattle even is looking at this right now. Sustainable Seattle is a movement to sort of advocate gross national happiness principles in that community. But it is very, very Western. They're very... The GNH in its native form was very Buddhist. It was just, you know, sensible, deliberate growth based in their religious beliefs. But now it's become something bigger. Brazil, Great Britain, the state of Maryland, there are parts of, I think Canada is committed to examining these principles. They're looking at the whole idea of how to integrate those concepts into how they do business.
Now, you mentioned it's embedded in the Buddhist concepts of happiness, but and the country is primarily Buddhist.
Yes.
But people aren't Buddhist freaks.
How do you mean?
I mean, they're not super religious,
well,
per se.
Right. They're much more interested in the culture of it than they are necessarily. And it's very different than Buddhism. What little I knew about it here in the United States as a longtime yoga practitioner and meditator, I thought I understood Buddhism, but it's a very complex thing, just as Christianity has many layers and branches, mm-hmm. and it's very complicated. But there, a lot of it is very ritualistic. People will wake up every morning. There's an altar in almost every house, and people will light incense and make an offering to the gods. And it's not necessarily rooted in the principles of Buddhism that I've studied in the United States, but that's a complex issue to talk about too, and I'm certainly no expert in it. But it was fascinating to watch it because in this country, of course, people often will keep their faith to themselves, and there's absolutely none of that. It's very, very out in the open, the practice and observation of days that are important and the consultation of monks and astrologers to make important decisions. It's very, very common there.
It's very important and very common, and yet the feel I get from reading your book is that they're not rubbing your nose in it either.
Well, they're not making you do it. They
right.
don't want you to do it. No, absolutely not. And they're actually very intrigued. I've had some great conversations over the years with young people who are very interested in the fact that Westerners know about Buddhism, that they know about Bhutan. They're very curious, and I think that stems from being isolated for so long. They're not used to people. You know, everybody in this country is used to all the mythology that people have about the United States, but there, people aren't used to that. So they're very flattered in a way that you even pretend to know a little bit about Buddhist belief.
Now, because of that tourist tax, it's $250 now. When you first went there, it was $200 a day.
Yeah.
It limits generally the kind of people, the kind of outsiders that get to visit the country. You have to have feel like they're, you know, to have that kind of money and are willing to take this sort of risk.
Yes.
And they probably tend to be pretty wealthy people.
Yes.
And you mentioned celebrities.
Yes. You know, it's not an easy place to get to in the first place, and then it's not a cheap place to get to by any stretch of the imagination. So, yes, you'd have to fall into one of those categories to go. But apparently, Drew Barrymore said last year that she had visited Bhutan and loved it. Demi Moore has gone. It's a very exotic travel destination. If you've been everywhere else in the world, it's mm-hmm. a great place to go. But it's also a place that's, you know, one of pilgrimage for many Western Buddhists. It's a beautiful place to go if you're an observant Buddhist to see it practiced in its native state or in a native state. So there's an interesting mix of people. But because of that, of course, the Bhutanese have an even grander perception of the United States and the people in it and our wealth. They just assume, I mean, I've spent a considerable amount of money going there. I haven't paid the tourist visa because I've always gone as a guest, but still, just the plane ticket alone is more than many Bhutanese people make in a year. So it's a very unequal and not representative kind of glimpse that they get of the United States.
And it's not necessarily the ugly American elk either.
No, they get people who are extremely respectful of the customs and traditions. The kinds of people who go to Bhutan are so thrilled to be in a place that is so pristine that they're very, very respectful of it. You know, even if they're unintentionally boorish, they're, for the most part, if you go there, if you go to the trouble and the expense to go there, it's not by accident. I mean, you're really, it's not like what I understand the Taj Mahal to be. People mm-hmm. go, they want to stand in front of it and take a picture. Maybe they marvel at the grandeur of it and the history. But Bhutan, there's no way to just sort of show up in front of it and take a snapshot. It's a very, you know, very deliberate place to have to get to.
Now, when people like Demi Moore or Drew Barrymore go there, where do they stay?
They stay. There's a very expensive series of resorts there called the Aman, and they're $1,000 a night. So there's five of them across the country. And typically, the wealthiest people go and stay in these quite beautiful sort of modern versions of Bhutanese structures that have all of the trappings, all of the amenities that you'd expect somebody paying $1,000 a night would want.
And you didn't get to stay there.
I did not get to stay there. I had lunch there, and I had tea there, and I've seen them. They're beautiful. I can see why people, if they're fantastically wealthy, would want to stay there, although I think if I had the money, I'd probably give it to help build the library I'm trying to get built in the mm-hmm. west, in the eastern part of the country. It's not my priority.
Well, so where did you stay? For relatively speaking, it was still a place of great luxury.
Yes, exactly. Where I stayed the first time was a little series of expat apartments. And so they were service apartments that were made for people who were there volunteering or working with various NGOs, non-governmental organizations. And so my apartment was very modest, but it was, you know, no smaller than the place I lived in at the time in Los Angeles, and didn't have a dishwasher, but it had running water, hot water, nice space heaters, a television. It was perfectly adequate. So it was fine, and it was perfectly luxurious by the standards of many Bhutanese.
We have to take another break. My guest is Lisa Napoli. She's author of Radio Shangri-La. It's about her experience starting up a youth-oriented radio station in the Himalayan Kingdom of Bhutan. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Last week on Car Talk, you missed a brilliant demonstration of first-rate diagnostic skill.
Yup, you press a little button, the door opens, you get in the car, and the things don't work anymore.
Right.
Is that true, Allison?
Yes.
All right, so now what? Now that you yelled at him for 10 minutes, what is she going to do about it?
I don't know. Don't lock the car.
For more clear and concise car advice, join us this week for Car Talk.
And Car Talk begins tomorrow at noon here on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here with 89.7 NPR News for All Sides Weekend. It begins in 20 minutes with Classical 101 host Christopher Purdy, and we'll hear about the best books for reading this spring. Joining Christopher in the studio will be WOSU book critic Cassie Rose, book critic Bill Eichenberger, and Capital University professor and poet Kevin Griffith. Join us for All Sides Weekend, beginning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency, Incorporated, serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses since 1855. More information at 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com.
64 degrees in downtown Columbus with a few clouds. Partly sunny today and a high near 75. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 55 degrees. And sunshine for Saturday, a nice day with a high right around 80. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Once again, we were listening to a broadcast from Kuzu FM, the youth-oriented radio station in Bhutan, that Lisa Napoli helped get started. Lisa is with us right now. She's the author of Radio Shangri-La. It's about her experiences in Bhutan, the Himalayan Kingdom of Bhutan. Lisa, the inheritance laws in Bhutan favor women.
Yes, they do. They do. Women get the land. They get the house. So it's not perfect for women there, as it isn't anywhere for anybody, but it's not a bad place. Yeah.
But like every society, Bhutan has its problems. There is a policy to preserve its cultural purity, and that has, I guess, a dark side. In the 1990s, tens of thousands of ethnic Nepalese were expelled from Bhutan and forced into exile.
Yes.
Tell us about that and why that happened.
Well, yes. So these ethnic Nepalese have been living in Bhutan, in some cases, for centuries. And in modern Bhutan times, well, I'll go back. It's only recently that Bhutanese started getting citizenship cards, literally card-carrying citizenship cards, the way we have Social Security and can't get around without them. And when those cards were being issued, when citizenship was officially being granted, because mm-hmm. the borders, of course, are porous in a place like that, the Nepalese were forced out because they couldn't prove they were really, quote-unquote, ethnically Bhutanese. The problem, according to the Bhutanese government, was they didn't have the infrastructure once they started schools, once they had free health care, which they instituted and still have today, to accommodate all of these people who'd come and who'd brought families and who'd increased their families while being in Bhutan. So they kicked them out. They moved them out, and Nepal didn't take them back because they hadn't been living in Nepal. So they languished in refugee camps for many, many, many years, and it's only in the last couple of years that negotiations have led to the resettlement of these ethnic Nepali Bhutanese citizens, majority of them in this country. So it's a terrible dark side of Bhutan, and it's yet another reason why in my title, Radio Shangri-La, Happiest Kingdom on Earth, there's irony. My book is more about the media influx into Bhutan and how globalization is changing Bhutan, because my experience hasn't been with the refugee issue. But as I learn more about it and have studied more about it, it's a really interesting and underexplored side of Bhutan. It's hard to get the Bhutanese themselves to talk about it. Again, many of the young people don't remember when it was happening, but the older people sort of, you know, say we needed to keep Bhutan to us because we couldn't accommodate those other people. So it's not dissimilar from the debates we have here with the immigrant Mexican population. And as the daughter of an Italian immigrant, I find the whole thing very fascinating and, of course, unsettling, and as everything else we're talking about, laden with paradox.
Glenn from Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. If you could maybe put together all the money it takes to get over there and pay the day fee, is there like a self-guided backpacking, hiking tour you can take and just wander the countryside, or do they like to kind of keep track of where you are?
They want to keep track of where you are. And in fact, that fee that you pay is inclusive of a guide and a driver. And part of that is they want to make sure the experience you get of Bhutan is very guided and you know, proscribed. But no, they don't want people running around the countryside backpacking.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
John from Canal Fulton, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Very intriguing thing to watch today. I'm a missionary in Haiti, where President Aristide declared voodoo the national religion. Is there a presence of any other religions, including Christianity, but others also in that country?
That's a wonderful question. Thank you. Yes, there is a presence. And it's guaranteed in the newly enacted constitution, their first constitution, freedom of press and freedom of religion. However, last year, someone from the South, who I believe was, I don't know much about except what I've read in the papers, but someone from the South was busted for showing what was said to be a Christian movie and jailed.
When you say someone from the South, you mean South Bhutan?
South Bhutan, okay. Sorry. Southern part of the country, so not in the main city. This happened. And so it's guaranteed in the Constitution. There's supposed to be a tolerance for it. I've met some people who are the offspring of Bhutanese and European marriage who are Christian, but you don't see churches yet in any sense of the word, and that's another evolving story with the place, for sure.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you. Good luck with your work.
Thanks, Jen. So it was sort of fun, Lisa, early on in the book, your reference to there, when you told somebody how you ended up going to Bhutan, they said, oh, it was karma.
Mm-hmm.
They're into their karma.
Yeah, it might have been my karma. You know, I find it's certainly a very interesting place for somebody like me who's worked in startup media for many years. I started my career at CNN for many years. I covered the beginning of the internet at the New York Times. And then for me to go to a place where media, there was a pure media landscape, or pretty pure. It wasn't, you know, completely nascent, but it's a fascinating place for somebody like me to have gone. The whole idea of my fascination with technology and how it changes our lives has been the case here in this country, as I say, while I was chronicling the dawn of the internet. So maybe it was my karma that I go to a place where the Constitution just guaranteed freedom of the press and everybody was starting radio stations. It has. I mean, now there are 7 stations since I first went there.
Wow.
7 newspapers where there were only 1 or 2 when I first went there. And that's just in 4 years. So think about what's happening with our profession in this country and how it's just exploding there.
I know where to go for a job.
I was just going to say. It's not a bad place. It's too bad they won't let us work in it.
I can't afford. Yeah, exactly. They don't allow. You couldn't go back there and work.
I couldn't. In fact, it was very one of the times I was at the radio station, the woman who was then running it made it very clear to everybody that I was not working there. I was volunteering there because you are not. They don't want foreign nationals not only owning media, but working in it. So they're very protective of that. And, you know, that's understandable as well. But again, it's complex.
Yeah, so they don't want them owning media. Does anybody outside of Bhutan own anything in Bhutan?
That's only beginning to happen. Foreign direct investment is what it's called, and it's starting now. But they're very careful about it, as, you know, in keeping with the GNH. If you wanted to come in and, I don't know, create something untoward or something that was very dangerous to the environment, they wouldn't let you. But if you want to start a hotel, like that Aman series of hotels is one of the first examples of foreign direct investment there. But, yeah, they're careful about what and who they let in. But if you've got some money, it's an interesting place to consider investing if you really have a long time to wait for a return on investment.
Did you ever adjust to the food?
I didn't. The food was a big challenge for me and still is. And it's probably why I didn't fall in love with it. My karma was not to fall in love with a Bhutanese man and stay there forever. It's very, very, very spicy hot. In fact, the spiciest hot food you've ever had is probably not as spicy as what Bhutanese people eat 3 times a day. So that was a challenge for me. I'm a very leafy green eater, and that's not something that's dominant there, although that's changing too. Health consciousness is taking on different meanings for different people, and people starting to exercise in ways they never had before. Of course, who needed to exercise in a country where you walked everywhere? Mm-hmm. But then as the city developed, you know, people were loving being in the car, because who wouldn't love that? But now people are recognizing their waistlines need some help, so you start to see people mountain biking around town, and that's kind of cool.
Good things, more radio stations, more newspapers, but what has been the downside of further exposing itself to the outside world and bringing in these sorts of things?
Well, it's a chicken and egg thing, because now that you have all these, you know, reporters running around, you have stories in the newspapers about terrible things, murders, suicides, there's domestic violence issues. There's a first women's shelter that's opened up, and there's, you know, alcoholism is an issue, substance abuse. But were those things there before? Of course they were. It's just now that they're being reported, you hear about them more and you hear about them differently. So it's the same sort of situation we have. There are all sorts of ills right outside our window, but until we know about them, and the way we usually know about them is either through a neighbor or through the media. So that's a fascinating and troubling thing to watch. And yet it's also a powerful thing, too, because if someone can be helped by the power of the media telling them that it's not okay for their husband to hit them, then that's a great thing. You know, they learn that they can get out and that there's a place for them to go. But that's been a fascinating evolution. The other thing is that ads are taking on a level of sophistication that they didn't have when I first went there just 4 years ago. So, you know, with ads come, I'm not an anti-capitalist and I'm certainly not an anti-consumerist, but I am an anti-excess. And, you know, you're starting to see a lot of people, a lot of businesses advertise in much more luxurious ways, sophisticated ways, which, of course, means that there's more of a call for more goods, and more goods mean people want more things, which means they have to make more money or do things they don't want in order to get the money to make to buy those things. And so it's a very interesting, complicated cycle. There's a big building boom there, too. People leave the country if they can, make some money, send it back, and build. And a lot of places are being built. There's not a lot of measured, deliberate growth in the capital city, which is ironic given that the country's stewardship says that we should have measured, deliberate growth. So it's a fascinating, fascinating place.
Is there still a monarchy there?
Yes, there is. It didn't go away when they elected this parliament 3 years ago this month. They have a monarch. He's 31. He's a single king who is Western educated, and he's revered around the country. He walks. He goes on 10, 12-day walking treks in very remote parts of the country. And the funny thing is that there are pictures that you can get on Facebook of him going to these remote places. But it seems like it's evolving the way Britain may evolve with in terms of their monarchy. But he's not totally off in the sidelines. He's involved.
And is there monarchy? Is it wealthy? Is he a wealthy person?
That's one part of Bhutan that's not been examined, and I can't imagine even all these new journalists will examine it any time in the immediate future. The rap on the king is that he lives humbly. His father lived humbly. His four wives lived in nice homes, but they're not supposedly given to excess. But that is something that is not examined in Bhutan, and it's when you ask the question, people sort of look in the other direction and pretend they didn't hear you asking it. So it's not really clear.
I was surprised that, and it maybe it's my ignorance of Buddhism or something, but that the idea of formal marriage is relatively new there.
Yeah, yeah. It's I think that the part of it is, you know, in this country, people didn't have lavish weddings necessarily unless they were supremely wealthy 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. I think that it's probably a mixture of Buddhist beliefs and also just cultural beliefs. It's not a big deal, you know. If you decide to live with someone, you're married, and if you decide not to live with them anymore, you're not. But of course, again, when there's more stuff and there's more at issue, people have different agreements and they have different disputes and they have different issues when they split. So that is becoming an issue. And also, if you start to see a lot of outside movies glamorizing fancy weddings and beautiful dresses, you know, people want that too. So, again, it's complicated.
What from Western culture is popular in Bhutan?
Wow. Well, you know, in the last 4 years, a bunch of coffee bars have opened up. And there wasn't a good cup of coffee except in a private home when I first went there. So
yeah, they like Nescafe.
They like Nescafe. Apparently a lot of Asia likes the Nescafe, but not anymore. You know, in Bhutan there's probably 5 or 6 cafes with lattes and good brewed coffee. In fact, I was in a very remote part in the middle of the country visiting one of the first libraries to be built in the country by Reed Global in October. And the man in the little shop, the one little shop in town, very proudly told me that the next time I came back that he would have brewed coffee. And this is 12 hours out of the capital city. I mean, so coffee craze as it is everywhere, seems to be coming there. And even though national dress, the wearing of the national dress is compulsory.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about
that. Yeah, you have to wear national dress to work, to office, to school. You know, at night, you want to put on your trendy jeans and your trendy heels and your nice handbag. You know, that's how it goes. Complicated. Keep saying that, but it's true.
Yeah, you've been back and forth about 6 times now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any end to this? Is this like just part of your future, that Bhutan has become part of your life?
I don't know. We'll see. It's hard to say. It's hard to say how this book will be received there. I'm scheduled to go to a literary festival that's hosted by the Indian Bhutan Alliance. I don't know. I don't know how to, I'm not a good planner, even now. So I just sort of see what happens next. So it's hard to say.
I love it. When you say you're not sure how it'll be received, meaning it wasn't highly critical of Bhutan. It just kind of laid out what you observed.
Yeah, but it wasn't authorized. I didn't write it in you know, concert with the government, which is how many of the books that have been published about Bhutan have been written. So that might be met with criticism.
Have you gotten very much feedback on the book so far?
Well, yeah, there was just a review by a Bhutanese woman who took issue with my rose-colored glasses of Bhutan, which I don't think I really had. But other reviews have been extremely positive. And the best thing, the most exciting thing for a first-time author especially, is I'm getting dozens and dozens of pieces of mail from people all around the world who are reading the book, listening to the book, who've either been to Bhutan or are curious about this whole journey that I took as a middle-aged person who kind of stepped out of the daily grind. So it's exciting that people are reading it and reacting to it and finding me online. And that, to me, as a journalist, is the most exciting thing possible. That not just that you could touch somebody's life, but that they'd be willing to take the time to write to you and share that with you. What could be any more amazing than that?
Well, Lisa Napoli, author of Radio Shangri-La, thank you so much for joining us today.
Gosh, thank you so much. It was so wonderful talking to you. You're a great interviewer. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And thanks to everybody out there for listening to All Sides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.